Now, Muslims in Ireland, of which there are between 65 and 70,000, are now 1 week into the holy month of Ramadan. So today we're going to chat with one man who's observing Ramadan. That's Aminullah Dasandi. Aminullah is based in Cork. He's the head of the religious department in UCC and he's also a senior lecturer in contemporary Islam. Good afternoon, Aminullah.
Hi, Lee. How are you?
Good to talk to you. Thanks for taking time out to talk to us. So you are in the middle of a day of fasting.
Yeah.
Okay. And that started at what time?
Too early. I mean, if I could just kind of go through the typical day, you wake up what would seem like in the middle of the night, you basically stuff your face and then you spend the entire day without food and drink. Now, you are supposed to contemplate God and draw closer to God through spirituality. But some of us might actually be thinking about what we're going to have when we break our fast. So, you know, you might spend a couple of hours in the evening thinking about what you're going to eat and then you just go and do the exact same thing the day after.
I was looking at
map. There are some people who don't. I mean, obviously, you know, if you're ill or you know you have a reason for not fasting, then it's not supposed to kill you.
Yeah, I was looking at a map of the world, and I think there's 17 hours of fasting in Ireland or thereabouts.
Yeah,
that'd be right.
And it's very long.
And is it 40 days? Is it or 30 days?
30. So 30 it's a
days.
Month.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And can you just tell us the history of it?
In the Quran, which is the text that Muslims believe in, it says, you know, fasting is prescribed for you as it was prescribed for those before you so that you may attain God consciousness. And when it talks about those before you, it's actually linking to Jews and Christians. Some say it was Jews and Christians in terms of the significance of fasting that was kind of started through biblical monotheism. So it's a spiritual kind of a ritual, which is to not have anything in your belly in order to, you know, draw closer to God and to think more carefully about your actions and think about virtues and morality as you're doing that. But it is, as I tell my students all the time, it is an extension of what is within Judaism and Christianity in terms of the significance of fasting. Now, of course, within Judaism, Christianity, the idea of fasting has changed, it evolves, but within the Islamic tradition, you still have, you know, this idea of fasting from food and drink from sunrise until sunset.
And is it strictly policed?
Well, again, see, it's about drawing closer to God, and you know, faith is such a grey area. It is something that can't be replicated from one Muslim to the other, which means that it's really up to you. So that means that you know you will have Muslims who'll be fasting the entire 30 days. You might have a Muslim who says, you know what, I'm going to fast today. I'm going to, I might miss it tomorrow. So it's really about personal relationships. Okay. I always joke to my students about the fact that anybody can go into the toilet and have a banana.
Right.
I'm sorry to make it.
Do you? But it just, do you it go? Just, do you the odd time go into the toilet and have a banana?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I just meant that each individual's piety and faith is very different.
Of course.
You know, yeah. I'm one of my favourite poets is this irreverent 19th century Mughal Indian poet who was a complete drunk. You would compare him to someone like Robert Burns, and he was very, very open about the fact that he didn't want to fast, but he was adamant that he was Muslim. And I think that type of, you know, character we very rarely see or hear of a Muslim in that way because we box Muslims too easily into what a Muslim should look like or what they should and shouldn't be doing.
Well, let's try and change that a little bit in the next 20 minutes or so, Aminullah. So first, let's find out a little bit about you and how you ended up in Cork. That's a Scottish accent, I hear.
It is. I'm a proud Glaswegian.
Okay, and your parents are originally from?
From Pakistan, Sialkot in the Punjab area.
Okay. And what's your family situation? What did your dad and mom do? How many children, etc.?
My dad was the only son of many, many daughters, sisters, and the onus was on him of going out and making money. So he travelled around a lot. He left Pakistan quite early and ended up in Hong Kong, Singapore, Yugoslavia, Germany, and then ended up in the UK. In between all of this, he married my mother. They're from neighboring villages. So that was basically the story. My dad came to the UK in the 50s. My mom in around about the, I think the 60s. And my dad did kind of menial, you know, kind of jobs. He was doing bread making, thread making, ended up running a corner shop in the south side of Glasgow for about 20 to 23 years. My father passed in 2010. My mother's still in Glasgow.
And Glasgow, of course, the divisions between Catholics and Protestants are well documented. You lived in a Jewish neighbourhood.
My dad's shop was in a Jewish neighbourhood.
Okay, right. Yeah. Okay. So you had all sorts of religions going on around you when you were growing up.
Absolutely. It was just, you know, I haven't even had enough time to reflect on what I went through. Like, you know, at home, my mum was adamant. Because my mum has very limited English. She would say, you know, you're not allowed to speak English at home. You're only allowed to speak Punjabi. And, you know, so we spoke Punjabi at home. My dad was a... You know, he had a corner shop, but he was suited and booted. He used to go to the shop, you know, dressed very smartly, you know, and it was just being part of that very kind of dazzling mix of west of Scotland sectarian divisions between Glasgow Rangers and Glasgow Celtic. And then, you know, at home, listening to my mum talking about how she bathed with buffaloes in her village was just something for me was quite beautiful. But the family was, we're a laugh-a-minute family. Everything was always tongue-in-cheek, taking the piss out of each other, right, which was amazing. And I think that's what really, you know, made me quite comfortable with religion.
Right. Explain that to me. You don't take it too seriously, is that it? Or
it was just, I think the connection between religion and humour is just so close. You know, it was like my mother used to say to my dad, right, it's time for prayer, we need to pray. And my dad would go and start singing the most erotic Bollywood songs to her. And we would be sitting there going, what on earth is going on? And I think in some way, there was always a balance. There was always this beautiful balance between something that's very, very serious. And on the other side, you could just, you know, absolutely have a laugh about it. So that was what made me very comfortable. But my Islam is very much connected with my parents' Pakistaniness, yes, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
And so, you know, I can't really separate it. Absolutely. You just can't separate it. Like, it, you know, at some level, I mean, I talk to my students here and who tell me, oh, you know, I don't know whether I'm Catholic anymore. And then they kind of start talking about what it means to them to be Irish. And I think, gosh, it's exactly the same about what I talk about when I talk about being Glaswegian, being Pakistani.
But they're not one and the same thing. Amanullah, like your culture and your religion are separate things.
I don't know. This is, I mean, I'm not sure. I just think.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, what do you think then?
I just think there's the way in which the rhythm of our society has so much religion crept into it. You know, it's very difficult to separate it. But I think we live at a time where it's very clear cut. We're at a time of Instagram and, you know, Twitter and so it's give me the absolute clear cut religion and secularism. And I'm just like, what does that mean? How do you create something that's completely secular or completely? I don't know.
My understanding of secularism is not that it's devoid of religion. Mm. But I suppose it's that religion has less power. It's the way you could say it is, it's indifferent to religion.
Right. I do like that. I think what is important there is that it's pluralism. So I'm really quite, you know, I get very excited about pluralism because I think what we need is I love the diversity of thought. I love somebody coming up to me and saying, you know, I'm kind of culturally, I mean, or whatever way you want to say it, Muslim, but maybe I don't really believe in God. And I just find that absolutely fascinating.
Now, what do you say when somebody says that to you?
I just say, that's great. What does that mean for you? You know, I just think it's absolutely wonderful. But the problem is that we're so busy damning people to hell these days that we don't take time to reflect on individuals. And religion can be weaponized in many different ways.
It has been throughout history.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it can start a liberation movement or it can absolutely, you know, kind of kill people.
Well, sectarianism is the, you know, we're very close to it here. Mm. So you, from an early age, questioned religion, but yet you're still religious. So the questioning, you obviously got answers then.
I did, and or I had good enough teachers who kind of kept me thinking. You know, I still remember I used to go to the equivalent of a Sunday school, which was an Islamic school, and I once asked the imam, I was just like, what if we're doing all these prayers and fasting for nothing? What if God doesn't exist? And I think back and I think, gosh, I was really brave in asking that question. And I had a really lovely imam who talked me through about ethics and, you know, having a focus of doing good things. And maybe the idea of heaven is a good idea that makes people do good things. And if God doesn't exist, then at least all of this goodness, you know, won't go in vain. And right. I just sat there and I thought, gosh, that, you know, I think back and I think I was very lucky to have an imam. I mean, I'm sure there are many imams.
Do you think, Amanullah, that if we didn't have the lure of a heaven and the deterrent of a hell, like, we wouldn't be barbaric? I think we're hardwired to be good.
I don't know. I mean, this goes back to a lot of the questions that my students ask. Do we need Judaism, Christianity, or Islam to be good people?
Yes.
And I'm like, look, everybody has their own path. Everybody tries to, you know, answer the three ultimate questions: where did I come from? What am I doing here? Where am I going to end up?
Right.
And you find those answers in a multitude of different ways. For me, Islam works. For somebody, it could be, gosh, none of this works. I just kind of find my way and. And I think that's beautiful. And I think that's what makes our society so bright and prosperous. But I do worry that we're losing sight of that, of being able to appreciate all those differences, that we become so angry at times with people who think differently from us.
So we have to listen. So a little bit back to your life story then. You're in Cork since 2015.
Yeah.
How did you end up in Cork?
I did my PhD in Glasgow, finished in 2009, and then I moved to the States for 6 years. So I taught for 1 year in upstate New York, and then I lived for 5 years in South Beach on Ocean and Third, and I taught at the University of Miami. And I just kind of got a wee bit tired of being at the beach all the time. I mean, I kind of thought, when's the party going to end? And I remember coming back to Glasgow one summer and my mum going, you know, it's all great that you got this job in Miami and you live at the beach and all that, but can you not come a little bit closer to Glasgow? And I went online and I just saw that there was a job up at UCC, and I applied. And to be fair, you know, all my mentors were like, you're never going to get that. It's a senior post and you're nowhere near that. And I thought, you know what, I'll just apply. And I got the job. So when I came to Cork, it was absolutely raining. And I thought, gosh, I was very nostalgic at this point after 6 years in the States. And the rain kind of reminded me of Glasgow. And here I am.
And of course, Glasgow is the second city, as is Cork.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are echoes there. And what about, you know, culturally then, Cork and you as a Muslim?
It's been tough. I mean, to be very honest with you, it's been very difficult. There's been times where I thought, what am I doing here? When I first came here, I thought, oh, it's, you know, I wasn't seeing enough people who looked like me. And they, whenever I raised questions about diversity, it was just always, oh, we don't talk about this, or, you know, this is. And I just feel in the last 5 or so years, Ireland has changed so significantly. I mean, Ireland is... I absolutely love being here. You know, the idea of the outward migration has turned to inward migration. But I think, you know, I kind of try to compare what it was like for me growing up in Glasgow. I think a lot of the heavy lifting was done by my parents' generation.
Yes, yes.
You know, my dad.
So we're going through that now. What,
yeah,
you know what I mean? So
it's
like
hard.
The UK is way ahead of us. It's probably 30
yeah.
or 40 years ahead of us when it comes to
absolutely
cultural diversity.
Yeah,
yeah.
But we'll get there. You know, I keep saying, because, you know, it's quite nice to come and reflect on your show about all this, because normally I'm wheeled out to talk about, you know, really difficult stuff about racism and being anti-racist and just make everybody uncomfortable in the room. But I just kind of think that we are going in the right direction. It's absolutely great to hear, you know, people kind of talking about multiculturalism and what that means for our society. It enriches our society. Look, people will never agree on this.
Do you think?
But I just think it's a good thing.
Do you think Irish people know enough about your faith? Your faith, sorry.
What surprises me sometimes is that many of my students, when I teach them about Islam, it takes them a wee while to appreciate that Islam and Muslims are not a monolith. And by that, I mean that they're not just this 1 billion people, mass of individuals who believe in all the same things. So I kind of try to say to my students, look, you understand that there's diversity of Christians, right? You have Protestants, Catholics, yeah. Methodists, you know, but Islam has exactly the same. And it's like, I come to sometimes think, gosh, it's coming down as quite a shocker. But my students are great. And, you know, I just feel that when they start and then when they come to the end of the course, it's just wonderful. And I just feel so many ideas have been broken down. Yeah. Look, when I teach, I'm not teaching them to go away thinking Islam is a religion of peace. That's not my job. My job is to make them think critically, to think that there are good Muslims, there are bad Muslims. Islam has certain aspects of history which are good and certain aspects of its history which aren't good. And I think once you have that lovely picture, I mean, it's not a lovely picture, but you know what I mean? Once yes. you have that complicated picture, it just puts us all at a bit more ease to see we're actually not that different from each other.
But what do you think are the common misconceptions about the negative aspects of Muslims?
I think a lot of the misconceptions are... one thing I feel is that Islam is often not associated with Judaism and Christianity, whereas it should be. I sometimes joke to my students, I said, you can't really separate them. They've been in bed with each other for a very, very long time. And it's because they all believe in that monotheistic biblical God. That's why I recently wrote a book with my former colleagues from Miami on this and an introduction to monotheism. So that was kind of key for me in building bridges.
So we all worship the same God.
I believe that. You'll have many people who will not believe that
okay.
as well.
Yeah.
I think also more on the intra-diversity. Like, I just think that we kind of box Muslims in a very clear way. Look, you have that ideal, you know, husband, wife, 2.4 children, whatever that means. But you've also got queer Muslims. You've got, you know, all of that diversity exists within Islam. And you have all the same tensions about, you know, challenging authority and trying to find space for women, etc. within, you know, mosques.
So a man sat in front of me here, a member of the Irish Muslim community, and told me that in his view, that homosexuality was a sin.
Well, again, it's, you know, religion is all about interpretation. So it depends on the interpretation. You know, I saw a tweet just the other day by one of the biggest LGBT Muslim organisations in the UK. And they were saying, you know, Ramadan is a very difficult time for queer Muslims because, you know, they're often fighting the double bind of Islamophobia and homophobia. And it just kind of made me think about how difficult a time it must be. And exactly the same kind of conversations that we've had here, you know, when it comes to talking about, you know, same-sex marriage and all of that, but it's not
would you
different.
Think though that you know, the UK are ahead of us when it comes to cultural and ethnic diversity? Do you think that, like, Catholicism is slightly ahead of Muslim when it comes to, you know, attitudes to women and attitudes to homosexuals?
It's all about who you ask. They, you know, you could be sat with somebody who'll say no, 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 and they'll just keep saying no to everything. And you'll meet somebody who's completely open. You might even meet a Muslim woman who's led prayers. You know, I just think that diversity exists, and a lot of these are happening in conversation with each other. You know, there was a ton of religious leaders who came together and spoke up against conversion therapy, you know, and there was Muslims there, you know, who said this is, you know...
This is the cure the gayness.
And I just think, you know, that gives us a lot of hope in terms of appreciating that diversity. One size doesn't fit all. And I'm not saying, I think what we need to do is we need to just appreciate that internal diversity, which is, for me, is really, really quite beautiful. Maybe I've got too much privilege at the university. I enjoy a good argument and a good discussion. But you also
in a way, you're sort of preaching to the converted, excuse the terrible pun, but they're there to study religion, so they're going to listen to you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Great to hear Amanullah Sunday on the show. Sunday, sorry. He's an exceptional colleague in UCC and constantly promotes tolerance, inclusivity and peace, says Ger. That's the chaplain down in UCC.
I didn't pay him to say that, by the way.
Yeah, right. As a retired member of the Irish Defence Forces, our service with the UN in Lebanon did educate us in the Muslim culture. They have a call to prayer. A Catholic church here has the Angelus. Muslims have Ramadan. We have Lent. We are not that far apart. Amazing culture, and the Lebanese are amazing people, says Seamus. And can you please ask your guest, who are the main people who are also in the Christian and Jewish religions? I know the three religions are collectively known as Abrahamic religions, but is Jesus and Mary and the apostles part of the Islamic teachings? Vinny wants
yes,
to know. They
in
are.
Short, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So Jesus is considered as a prophet in Islam, and Muslims also believe in the Immaculate Conception.
Yeah.
I was driving. Can I ask you?
I have you on. Just like,
yeah.
Like life before religion.
Uh-huh.
Man lived before religion was invented.
Uh-huh.
Did he?
Did
man existed? Humans existed before religions existed.
Where are you taking me with that question?
No. Well, the reason, like, you know, like some people describe, maybe we're entering into a post-religious society.
Look, you know what it is? The way I think about it is, set aside all of the ideas that we have about religion, because I think when we say religion, something happens in people's minds. They start thinking about stuff, and we've been programmed at some level to think about religion. When I say Islam, right, I don't know whether you think of peace and tolerance, but when I say Buddhism, or I talk about, you know, yes, the Dalai Lama, but set that all aside for a second, and I keep going back, and I always say this to my students, I look, we've got three ultimate questions that I think human beings, any human being, is going to continually
give
ask
us them again.
Where did I come from? What am I doing here? Where am I going to end up? And the answers to those are absolutely beautiful. Let's revel in that diversity.
So we're
and
driven.
But
here's
so
the thing.
Better.
Here's the thing. We're driven to answer those questions, aren't we? We're sort of. It's in our DNA to find answers to those questions.
At some level, some people might not want to spend time thinking about them, though.
Yeah. But what I'm getting at is that sort of religion fills that sort of void, if you like.
Yes, and religion offers hope. Look, we're going through a pandemic where we're bombarded with numbers and figures and this and that. Where am I going to get my hope? I love scientists, and scientists are helping me through the pandemic. Uh-huh. But hope comes from, you know, your arts, your culture, your religious stories, any way that you want. I get hope from all of that, from music that makes you just think. So there's a lot of goodness in religion. We just have to expand our understanding of the word.
We leave it on a positive note. We were speaking to Professor Brendan Kelly last week on his book, The Science of Happiness, and people who have a strong religious belief are happier than people who don't. So there you go. He's gone.
Thank you, Ray.
Okay, right. Dr. Aminata Dasandi, thank you very much.
But let me just say, finally, there are probably a lot of people who don't follow any systematic kind of religion who live very full and happy lives. So I think I just want to...
That'd be me.
Yeah, and I think we just have to appreciate that. Yeah. It's all about meaning and making meaning of our life. And hopefully we're all driven towards love and peace and drawing closer to each other and understanding that we're not really that different.
Okay. It's been a real pleasure talking to you, and I'm sure we'll talk again. Thank you. Aminullah. Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.